Welcome to the Errata Movie Podcast. Today we're talking about 18 summer movies, big and small, including the new film from M. Night Shyamalan called The Happening.
Science will come up with some reason to put in the books. But in the end, it'll be just a theory.
This is Robert Davis. You know, it's been a while since we've done one of our speed round episodes on this podcast where we talk about a bunch of new movies briefly, and we're going to do that today. And to get into the spirit of things, I decided that I'd speak at double the normal rate. Well, I didn't actually do this on purpose, but I think I felt a backlog of words lately. I just recently moved from San Francisco to Chicago, and so I've been buried in boxes, and because of that, I haven't posted a lot on my website. So they all spilled out today. Good luck. Here's J. Robert Parks.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
How are you?
Good.
We haven't talked about new movies in a little while. We've been kind of catching up on interviews that we've done and smaller movies that are a little bit older that we liked. But it seemed like a good time here as we're getting well into the summer to talk about some of the movies that have come out this summer, both the ones we've liked and maybe the ones we're not as crazy about. I thought it might be fun to talk about one of the last movies you saw before you left San Francisco, which was Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
In fact, that is the last screening I saw in San Francisco at the fabulous Castro Movie Palace.
The setting at least was good. What do you think of the movie?
It was a way to go out. I thought it was a lot of fun. Mm. Of course, I love Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I loved the two sequels. When I saw them, you know, as a kid, but in retrospect, I don't like them nearly as much as they haven't aged for me as well as the first one has. Mm-hmm. So I felt like this fit right in with them. In other words, I didn't feel like there were three movies that could be tarnished necessarily by a fourth, right, because I thought the other two, the second and third, were already sort of, you know, they were okay and had their moments, but not great movies. So I thought this was a fine one in that tradition. It's weird to see how movies have changed since Raiders of the Lost Ark, especially. You know, it's sort of weird to see not only Indiana Jones in a different era, you know, they've advanced him 19 years, which is how long it's been since the last movie, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. So he's older, he's in a new era, he's in the nuclear era. And so not only is his world different, but the world of movies is just so different. I mean, the way action scenes are typically cut, the way digital effects allow you to do anything. And I got the sense that Spielberg was trying to sort of be restrained in that regard, although there is some of that's in this movie. But it wasn't like every other action movie of the summer that is just completely frenetic and wall-to-wall digital effects. It was really, there were stunts, you know, crazy stunts. And so I thought it was a lot of fun. What did you think?
It's funny. I liked the stunts that had physicality to them. You know, talking about this being a different age of movie making, and so you can do so many things with digital. And I agree that Spielberg is relatively restrained. I mean, it's not like, you know, Speed Racer, of course, but still the movie or the stunts that seem set against a green screen, of which there are many, just don't work as well for me. And I think part of it's my nostalgia for Raiders of the Lost Ark, which strikes me as a much more physical film. And so maybe judging it in that light is unfair, but I found myself, particularly in the long fight scene and chase scene through the jungle, I found myself getting, legitimately bored. But there are lots of nice moments in the film. I thought Harrison Ford acquitted himself well. Shia LaBeouf doesn't do as much for me, but I'm not sure I'm the target audience for his presence in this movie. But it was fine. You know, nothing great, nothing terrible. I'm glad I paid matinee price for it.
I'm someone who also, of course, loved the Star Wars movies when I was young. And then when I saw what George Lucas was doing with the newer ones, I really hated those more recent three. I mean, I guess the last one was okay because it was a little darker and it sort of hooked in with the original three that we loved. And so this isn't in that category to me. This is much closer to the original. I agree with you that it doesn't feel as physical for some reason, or it feels a little more, it's almost hard to explain, but Raiders of the Lost Ark feels sort of lovingly made or something. Some difference there.
Yeah.
And I think one thing I don't like about this, the new one, The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, is it feels a little bit like it was made by a committee. You know, like, we need to have this. We need to have this part. Mm-hmm. We need to have the young guy who can maybe bring in the younger audience or carry the mantle if need be in the future. Mm-hmm. We need to mention things about the era, but we don't want to commit to anything because we don't want to offend anybody. You know, there's like, Indy uses this phrase, "I like Ike," but I can't tell if he's if he's using it sarcastically or if he means it. And then there's one of his peers mentions the sort of Red Scare that's going through the campus where he teaches. But it's not Indy who mentions it, and he's sort of noncommittal. So it's like these are just tokens of things that were going on, and yet who knows what Indy thinks about any of that stuff. It doesn't matter, but it's funny how these things are sort of assembled, you know?
That for me is the problem, is that it doesn't matter. And yet, you know, like, I don't care about, you know, a Marlon Brando reference, or if, you know, the preps and the greasers get into a fight, you know, that's, who cares? But I do care about how something like the Red Scare is handled. And for me, for it just to be merely production design, you know, merely sort of this thing that they cast off in a light moment, that strikes me as more problematic. I almost wish they had just left that out altogether. You know, who cares that it's made in 1957? Let's just set it somewhere in the 50s, and that's okay. You know, yeah, we're fighting the Soviets right now, although Kate Blanchett seems strangely Nazi-like. but that's okay too. You know, we can be nondescript, but actually bringing in history for some weird superficial reason, that bothered me a bit.
Well, you know, there's been this, the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles was a TV series that sort of filled in some of the backstory of Indiana Jones, supposedly, and it was made, you know, on TV after the last movie, but before this one, and was each week was about a different historical, you know, figure that Indy was running into. It was a little bit like Forrest Gump or something, where it was, wow, he's met a lot of people, you know, for a professor. But anyway, I liked the action sequences the best. I mean, any of the story stuff, I think I was very bored by. And in fact, you mentioned this chase through the jungle. I've heard so many different things about that I've figured out that people fall on one side or the other. They either think that was long and boring, too boring, or they really liked that and thought it was exciting. And I thought it was exciting. That was probably one of my favorite parts of the movie, because it sort of builds on itself in silly ways, admittedly. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're at one point they're dueling with swords on the top by standing on the tops of Jeeps. I mean, it's just ludicrous, and yet it's really funny, I thought. And it was just, the other thing I liked about it is it really showcased Spielberg as an action director, I thought, because there are four or five characters that he's juggling on two Jeeps and a couple of vines that are hanging above them. And yet I always knew where each person was. Mm-hmm. You know, they're leaping from Jeep to Jeep, but I sort of had a sense of where everything was. And then when they break out of the jungle, you know, it's not over yet. There are more menaces. There's more menacing things out there. And so I sort of like the escalating, cascading action. And it stands in contrast to typical action movies these days, where it just is disorienting. The idea is to cut it so fast that if you blink, you miss what's going on, where this wasn't quite that way. It feels very fast, but I knew where everything was.
Yeah. No, I mean, Steven Spielberg is clearly a much better director than, say, Michael Bay. And you know, where I get the sense that a lot of action directors, they cut a scene so that it's incomprehensible just because they never really got the footage in the first place, or they really didn't know how to create it. And so then it's just, well, we'll just throw it in the mix, turn on the blender and hope that people are razzle dazzled. So no, I agree that these action sequences are much better than the norm. But still it, for me, it just felt like it went on a while. And it also fit in with just the silliness of the film. And it's sort of unabashedly silly, and that's fun. But I got kind of tired of that too. Maybe I'm just old.
You know, another thing I liked about the movie was the look. It has this really strange light in the beginning, especially. It begins in New Mexico, so it's these really broad landscapes and this sort of harsh light that cuts sideways and gives everything everything sort of looks like it's glowing from an internal light, you know. But it's this low sun, and I liked that look, and I hadn't seen that look in an Indiana Jones movie, although I keep hearing that they tried to mimic the look of the original movies. Well, this looked really different to me.
Yeah, it did to me too.
But I liked how sunlight was very important, not just in that scene. They carried that then to this New England campus where Indy teaches, and then it was even that chase through the jungle, which you think would be fairly dark. There's this chasm through the treetops that brings this light streaming through. That's really neat. And this is, you know, in real contrast to the Temple of Doom, for example, that seems like it's just constantly underground and dark. And this was just like, out in broad daylight. And I like that look. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
Not that he doesn't go underground, of course. Not that he doesn't go into caves, of course. No,
of course. Well, a movie that my guess is that you don't like quite as much that comes out, just coming out this past weekend, called The Happening, M. Night Shyamalan's new movie, the guy who broke on the scene with The Sixth Sense and did Signs and then has disappointed people since, I think. What did you think of this one?
I thought it was terrible. And I liked The Sixth Sense, but, you know, its coattails are only so long. And for a lot of people, they didn't quite extend to his last movie, Lady of the Water, and they didn't for me. I didn't like that movie either. But this movie, I feel like he's trying to sort of rewind a little bit to, you know, Sixth Sense world or maybe Signs because it's spooky, creepy. It's really creepier and more grisly than anything he's done since Sixth Sense. And yet it's so hokey.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Oh, yeah. It's hard to defend the film. I think I probably liked it a little bit more than the hooting and hollering critics in our screening did. I mean, it's people were laughing at this movie about the 10th minute. And I didn't give up on it quite that early, but no, it's hard to defend. For those people who haven't seen it or read about it much, Mark Wahlberg plays this high school biology professor, or teacher, I guess, who happens to find out that there's been this horrible event in Central Park where people just basically go crazy and commit suicide, and that starts spreading, and it spreads all over the East Coast. And so Mark Wahlberg and his wife, played by Zooey Deschanel, and friend, played by John Leguizamo, have to get out of town. They figure that being in the cities is too dangerous, and if they get out into the pristine wilderness of Philadelphia or Pennsylvania, they'll be okay. And for me, it was kind of spooky for a while. There's something really creepy about the fact that people just suddenly start committing suicide. And I thought the movie handled that at least in an interesting fashion.
Although it starts to seem like an excuse to show a lot of creative suicides after a while.
I know.
I mean, he's got a whole pack of them.
Yeah, I found that troubling too. But also the dialogue is just awful. You know, it's really wooden. And it's all designed to sort of give exposition in really clumsy ways. The acting struck me as bad across the board. And after a while, you just have to laugh. I mean, the explanation they come up for why this is happening is just unbelievably stupid. But then it leads to these sort of random shots of plants as if they're supposed to be spooky. And you just can't help but laugh at that. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, there's a movie from earlier in the summer called The Ruins that was a much better Plants Are Out to Get Us movie. But yeah, my favorite part of The Happening, this encapsulates my whole feeling of the movie, is John Leguizamo is driving in a Jeep. Of course, everybody's trying to flee the city or flee whatever it is. They're actually trying to get ahead of the wind, which I loved. There it comes, they say. Anyway, so they're fleeing the wind, and they're in this Jeep, and they're driving, and he looks up, and he notices that the canvas top of this Jeep, it has a slit in it.
Yes.
And there's a zoom into the slit, and there's a look at his horrified face, and there's music that swells. And then there's a little more zooming into the slit, and there's a look at his face, and there's music that swells, a little more zooming into the slit. And I was thinking, yeah, this is a problem because Jeeps are so airtight to begin with. Yeah, and that's not just one thing in the movie.
No.
The movie is littered with tons of these kinds of things.
No, it is. I mean, it's the problem is, I was talking with a friend. I actually liked Signs quite a bit. And this movie is clearly trying to be something like Signs, where there's this mysterious problem and our hero,
and a comment on the world.
Yeah. And a comment on the world. Yeah. I can do without that. But, in Signs, the nice thing was that they didn't really show you anything or try to even explain anything until well into the film, you know, about 2/3 to 3/4 of the way through. Whereas with The Happening, you know, because Mark Wahlberg's this biology teacher, he's like trying to figure it out from the very beginning, and his answers or his ideas are so crazy. And yet then you realize the movie actually expects us to swallow those. And it's like, oh man, just don't show us. I mean, just let us, if the only way this can work is if we don't know anything at all and we just sort of swept along on the mood and the creepiness, but nah, doesn't do that.
Yeah. And I have to say, I didn't go in wanting to hate it. I really wanted to like it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I go to most movies wanting to like them.
Absolutely.
And there's the very first shot of the movie, just the credits. You don't really see anything but clouds moving backwards. There's this harp music. Mm. And it sounds like Bernard Herrmann or something. It sounded like really classical kind of spooky music, mm-hmm. you know, not modern kind of low rumble that shakes the THX theater, but yep. a harp. And so I thought, oh, this could be cool if he's sort of hearkening back to a different era, and mm-hmm. and then it was just downhill from there.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But well, you saw Kung Fu Panda. What'd you think of that?
I did, and I can recommend that. You know, here I don't want to sound like the snob who doesn't like summer movies. No, Kung Fu Panda is great fun. I like Jack Black, and the movie takes full advantage of his persona. You know, as he's playing this panda who's in love with Kung Fu and then actually has the chance to become the dragon warrior, you know, the Kung Fu master that will save the day. And so Jack Black's voiceover is really great. The animation is beautiful. And the way that the movie uses color, and it also, in the 3D sequences, or not 3D, but this kind of lively computer animation that almost looks 3D, that's really interesting, and I think they handle that really well. But there are also these dream and fantasy sequences that don't use that style of animation, that instead use almost like a picture book style of drawing and color. And oh, those are beautiful. The movie actually opens with one of these dream sequences. And man, I was hooked from the very first minute of that. And so I had a good time. And Jack Black is fun. I can't say as much for the other celebrity voiceover actors. They're pretty boring. Angelina Jolie, dull. David Cross, surprisingly dull. Hmm. Jackie Chan, dull. Dustin Hoffman has a few good lines, but also sort of strangely dull. I didn't even realize it was Lucy Liu's voice, and it was just kind of boring. I've grown really tired of animated movies using these celebrities who aren't really voiceover actors. They only choose them because they help market the film. It's like, oh, Angelina Jolie's in that. I like her. Maybe I'll go see this. Whereas if they got people who actually are good at voiceovers, then I think the movie would have been a lot better. But Jack Black is great. And the movie is beautiful and fun. And I had a great time.
And another movie with lots of colorful 3D animation and pandas is Guy Madden's new movie, My Winnipeg. Or wait, I may have my wires crossed on this.
Although, wouldn't it be great if Guy Madden actually did like a animated film? I mean, there's been sort of stop motion stuff in his movie. If he did just sort of straight out animation, that would probably be pretty sweet.
He'd probably animate it in the camera. Of course, Guy Madden is this guy who does movies that often seem very influenced by silent film. And they sometimes look like maybe they were unearthed from 1934 or something. You know, someone found them in a can or a vault or something. But they're new, brand new movies. And he's from Winnipeg. And My Winnipeg is a movie about his hometown.
Mm-hmm. And about his family, you know, and what it was like growing up. Well, of course, that's maybe saying too much. I mean, Guy Madden's films are wonderfully funny, I think, really dry and weird and sometimes silly, sometimes a little creepy. And My Winnipeg, I think, is all of those. And so the movie is ostensibly about his attempt to get out of Winnipeg and to escape his family. But I'm not sure how seriously we're supposed to take any of that.
Yeah, he often seems to be mining his past, and mm-hmm. after a while you start to wonder, my God, what is his past? What's wrong with his mother or his childhood? And you know, he has these stories in here about what his childhood was like, and of course it all seems ridiculous, but yeah. I have a feeling his mother must be a good sport. But
yes, I think so. Or they're not on speaking terms and haven't for a long time. It's one or the other.
So. Now, I didn't like this movie quite as well as some of his, in part because it feels a little bit like sort of a bunch of little anecdotes about Winnipeg. And I liked a lot of them, and some of them not as much. They're sort of little imaginary histories, I think, about Winnipeg. And maybe if I were from Winnipeg, I would catch some in-jokes that I'm not getting by being from Missouri and San Francisco and Chicago. you saw it in Toronto with an appreciative audience, I imagine.
Yes, and not just in Toronto, but the closing night of the Toronto Film Festival with a very appreciative audience. And it was great fun. And it's always great to see a comedy where everyone is laughing in the audience. You know, that just makes it a lot more enjoyable. And I think there probably are a lot of in-jokes that I didn't get. Guy Madden's obsession with hockey is one that I also share. And so all the hockey stuff I enjoyed. And also I grew up in a kind of a smaller city with an industrial background. And so I sympathized with this desire to get out into something new and different and having trouble doing that. So the movie appealed to me on those personal levels as well.
Yeah. Oh, ironically, he still lives in Winnipeg. So,
and I think loves living in Winnipeg is my guess, but
I think so too. Yeah. And you know, even as someone who doesn't care for hockey, in fact, doesn't follow any sports at all, I thought the hockey stuff was fun too. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has such hatred for this arena that was built to replace his beloved old arena. You know, I love those parts.
Yeah. You saw a much bigger movie, not necessarily for an American audience, but just in its production values, called Mongol. What's that about?
Mongol was the movie submitted by Kazakhstan for the Oscar, Best Foreign Language Oscar this year. But really, it's this huge multi-country international production. You know, if you go in thinking, oh, this is going to be a film from Kazakhstan, and you look at how obviously expensive this movie was with its huge battle scenes and digital effects, you think, wow, what sort of industry does Kazakhstan have? I should be paying more attention to their film industry. But no, it was directed by a Russian filmmaker and has money from lots of different countries. But it's the story of Genghis Khan, the origin story of Genghis Khan. So we see him as a kid and follow him up until he sort of fairly early in his life assembles armies and starts to try to unite the Mongol hordes, which are just a diverse, you know, group of tribes. And it's an interesting look at Genghis Khan, because I think that whether you see Genghis Khan as a hero or a menace probably depends on, you know, where you grew up or what your history classes were teaching you. But in this movie, he's a hero and he's a family man and he is proud of his Mongol heritage and teaches his kids that one day everyone is going to speak the Mongol language. Mm. And yet the film has these big action scenes that almost look like something from Kurosawa, you know, with big armies and very stylized action, really more in a modern sense than Indiana Jones, probably. I mean, there's lots of sort of stuff I can't quite tell what's going on, but then I see some digital red blood, you know, slow-mo into the air, and so I assume that blade caught some flesh. But it's between the few big sort of exciting battle scenes is lots of slow stuff that I wouldn't mind, you know, slowness if it were sort of giving us a window into Genghis Khan's head, but I don't have the slightest idea what this Genghis Khan thinks or believes. There are some sweet moments and there are some neat moments, and there's just beautiful photography that's clearly not shot on this continent. You know, they shot this deep in, you know, remote areas of Kazakhstan and Mongolia, and it really shows. It's really beautiful, and yet it felt so surface level as far as Genghis Khan as a character or who he is. It wasn't exciting. I didn't feel like I was learning a lot about Genghis Khan. And so I think I would have liked it better if they had either, you know, embraced the Hollywood mold, which they're sort of skirting, either really totally embraced it and give us a big, crazy action movie, or don't bother to go that route and give us something more interesting about Genghis Khan, you know? And it's sort of in the middle of those two and doesn't really satisfy either.
How about, I know the movie you saw, I didn't see Mongol, and I didn't see War, Inc. either. What's that about? I know it's got a John Cusack and a whole bunch of other people in it.
Yeah, this is another Iraq film from John Cusack. I say that because he had a previous movie called Grace Is Gone, which was about sort of the tragic side of the war and losing someone that you love in the war. This is an absurd comedy. And it seems like it was made in the shadow of Doctor Strangelove, Kubrick's great, great movie from, I don't remember what year, but about the Cold War. And this is absurd in that way. You know, we really could use a Doctor Strangelove, I think, for our generation and our war, but this isn't it. This movie is just scattered and all over the place. Most of the jokes aren't very funny. But I think one thing, when I was thinking about why is Doctor Strangelove, you know, laugh out loud funny and this isn't, I think part of the reason is that Dr. Strangelove was just following the logic of nuclear detente, you know, and it stuck to it very clearly. Everything that happens in that movie makes a weird sort of sense, you know, that a doomsday device would be built to destroy the world. It made a little bit of sense in the logic of the movie, or that you would tell your bombers, don't listen if we tell you abort, because it might be a message from the Ruskies, you know? Well, this movie doesn't really hook into the logic. The general idea is that what if wars were even more commercialized than they are now? And so corporations were sort of more, involved. In fact, the government outsourced wars to corporations like Halliburton, and they were the ones running the war. And yet it doesn't sort of follow that logic to anything that's absurd. All the sort of absurdity just comes from the chaos that was already inherent in this situation. So, yeah, it really, really misses a golden opportunity, I think.
Mm. That's a shame. A movie that you and I both liked, I think maybe me a little more than you, is a French film called Roman de Gare, directed by Claude Lelouch, who I haven't seen any other of his movies, I don't think.
Yeah, I haven't either, although he's been making movies for a long time.
Yeah, and some of them have played in the United States, and I just haven't had a chance to see them. But this one I thought was really fun. It's kind of a suspense thriller. The movie stars Audrey Dana as this woman who we find out, not exactly at the beginning of the film, but early on in the film, she and her fiancé get into this huge fight, and he actually abandons her at a gas station. And at this gas station is this kind of creepy guy. We're not quite sure what his angle is. It's played by the wonderful actor Dominique Pignon, who I know best from this movie called City of Lost Children that came out maybe 10, 15 years ago. And he takes a fancy to her, and again, we're not quite sure why, but she was on her way to her parents to sort of show off her fiancé, and in this moment of desperation, she asks if he will play that role for her, if he'll pretend to be her fiancé. Now, we've seen that in other movies before, but here the effect is quite different because there are intimations that this guy might be some sort of serial killer who's escaped from prison. And for me, one of the real fun things about this film is how it tosses out just a whole series of possibilities, some of which are pretty clearly red herrings, others of which, well, we're not quite sure what's going on. And so I just had fun going with the film, watching how it subverts audience expectations and what we are afraid might happen or what we sort of secretly wish to happen.
Yeah, you mentioned that this guy is a little creepy, and we're not sure why, but it's because they have very deliberately planted the possibility that he's the serial killer,
yep.
Or he might be just a ghostwriter for a famous author,
right.
And so it's not clear which of those, or he might be this other guy who has left his family behind, or maybe all of those three are the same person, you know?
Yeah,
yeah. Or it's a ghostwriter who also was a serial killer, who also has just left his family, you know, and so... I love that too. And this guy, you mentioned he's in City of Lost Children. He's actually in many of Jean-Pierre Jeunet's films,
yep.
Maybe all of them. He was in Delicatessen, was the first place I saw him. But he was even in Amelie, and I think he might have been in The Alien. Didn't Jean-Pierre Jeunet direct one of the Alien movies?
Yes, he did.
He's the guy with a kind of a big forehead, and I don't know, something about his mouth is a little funny, and so he can very easily appear to be a kind of a goofy or off-center person, which works well in this movie.
Yeah, it does. And it's nice, too, because I think he's a really great actor. And here he has a chance to have a pretty meaty role that doesn't require him just to be weird. You know, there's some moments where he is, but there's moments where there's real pathos there. And so I like that about this film a lot.
Yeah, because he really has to find the intersection of those three possible people who he might be and always allow us to think that he could be any one of them.
Yeah.
And in fact, you mentioned that you like the movie better than I do. And I think that's just because in the third act, there's a real need to sort of tie up a bunch of loose ends, and it drops a lot of the things that I liked about the movie before that, which was the relationship between the guy and this woman and sort of how they're spending time, and we're just wondering who he's going to turn out to be. And they have to answer those questions. And so at some point that has to end. And so I just regretted that it had to end, you know?
Yeah. And for me, I didn't mind because I realized once they had run out of red herrings or once they had run out of ways to subvert audience expectations, they really do rush to the end. You know, the movie just gallops at full pace. And so I liked that.
Speaking of galloping at full pace.
Yes.
Speed Racer is probably the fastest movie of the summer in terms of number of shots, you know, David Bordwell does these, I don't know actually how he does this, if he sits down with a DVD or what, but he does these charts where he analyzes how many shots per second a movie has. And it's really interesting to compare, you know, look at old movies and see how newer movies have changed, that they have many more shots per second.
Yeah.
But Speed Racer is just a manic piece of filmmaking. You know, Paste Magazine no longer requires reviewers to assign a star rating to a review. And so this was one of the first movies I got to review where I didn't have to do that. And I'm really glad, because I don't know what I would rate this movie, because it's not enjoyable to watch. At least it wasn't for me. You know, in these kind of summer movies, you just want some excitement and you want some adrenaline and some, maybe a few jokes and take us to the end. You know, this doesn't have any of that. It doesn't have a lot of excitement. There's nothing that's really particularly funny. It lasts a long time. I think it's over 2 hours or close to 2 hours.
So the races aren't exciting?
No, because you can't really tell at all what's happening. And yet, there are so many little tiny tidbits that seem so inventive. When these guys are racing so fast that if they have a wreck, they pop out automatically. All this is computer animated, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, the movie is, at some parts, it's just wall-to-wall animation, even though there are live actors, you know, also starring in the movie. But the races are completely animated, but the wreck happens, and it happens so fast that these guys are ejected out of the top, and then they're suddenly surrounded by this foam bubble that then bounces to safety and drops down into this drain that's in the floor. That's so cool, but I mean, it's so fast. It literally is like 2 seconds. If you blink, you can miss it. I bet you could interview the people coming out of the theater, and a good percentage of them would not even know what you're talking about if you ask them about the foam bubble. You know, but there are lots of things like that. Like, there's a tunnel that the guys go through in the end, and the walls of the tunnel are zebras running. And they look like Edward Muybridge's shots of moving animals. You know, it's sort of like an ode to cinema in some ways. The early days of cinema are joining the early days of cinema with now the very latest in computer technology. And so there's so many tiny things like that, but each one of them is so brief that they don't sustain a movie this long.
Well, I saw Iron Man, which is not a on that order, but it's a very worthy and yet still disappointing action movie. I know a lot of people have been really excited about Iron Man, and they already are talking about the sequel coming out in a couple of years. And there is a lot to like. Robert Downey Jr. is great as this guy named Stark. He's this sort of businessman come military man come ladies man. And early on in the film, he is captured and actually held hostage in Afghanistan, and is able to break out from his captors by creating his own rudimentary Iron Man suit. And then when he gets back home to California, I think, he realizes what he really wants to do is to do good in the world. And one of the ways that he might be able to do good is to create a really advanced Iron Man suit and then become a superhero and save the world. Well, Robert Downey Jr. is fantastic. He's just really funny and dry and has a real great sense of what it is to be an action hero and yet not take himself too terribly seriously. And the bad guys, I won't give them away because the movie tries to surprise you a little bit, at least, with who the bad guy is. But the bad guys are suitably menacing and dangerous. And their action sequences are good and the dialogue is strong. And I think Jon Favreau is a good director. And yet the movie doesn't exactly fall apart in the last half hour. But it's so retarded in the way it trots out cliches that are just unnecessary. You know, like, for example, in this climactic confrontation between Robert Downey Jr. and the bad guy, the bad guy, at his moment of triumph, actually has to let his guard down so he can taunt Robert Downey Jr. I mean, how many times have we seen this in a movie, and why do they possibly have to let it come out again?
Doesn't really, you know, I think Roger Ebert's movie glossary has an entry on this, the talking killer.
Yes. Yes.
Well, if killers just weren't so talkative.
Yes. Well, not only does the killer stop to talk, he actually like takes off part of his armor so that he's even more vulnerable. It's just retarded. But there's other stupid things, like Gwyneth Paltrow plays, you know, the Miss Priss. She's the, you know, the loyal assistant who also looks smashing in a backless dress. And so her one moment of heroism is when she has to sneak back into Stark's old office and download some things from his computer, because Stark has been shut out from his office. Well, if Stark has been shut out from his office, how can Gwyneth Paltrow go back in? And how can she get onto his computer and just start downloading things willy-nilly? I mean, how super smart can this bad guy be to let this happen? But now it gets worse, because then the bad guy actually comes into the office while she's there. You know, while she's sitting at his desk, you know, surreptitiously trying to download files. Does he ask her anything about what she's doing? No. Does he sort of, you know, say, hey, what's going on here? No. And then when she leaves and he actually realizes what she's done, does he try to stop her? No. It's the weirdest thing. It's like this huge plot device, and all it is a plot device, depends upon our super villain being super stupid. And it just drives me crazy because, you know, you have got this comic book movie in which the laws of physics do not apply. So therefore, you can make up whatever crap you want. And yet they have to rely on the hoariest of cliches. It's just so infuriating to me. Because, again, it's a good movie. There's lots of really good things about it. The first, you know, three quarters of the film is top-notch, at least as far as summer blockbusters go. And yet it's just lazy. And for me, what's most irritating is how insulting it is to the audience. In other words, it knows that the audience is so undiscriminating that it can do whatever the heck it wants, and the audience will swallow it up. And it did.
Yeah, that's too bad. Did you see the new David Mamet movie, Red Belt?
I did. And I liked it to a degree, although, unfortunately, a little bit like Iron Man, the ending disappointed me. How about you?
Well, at first it seems like it's going to be a real departure for David Mamet because it's a jiu-jitsu movie. Mm-hmm. But once you get into it, it quickly becomes clear that it's David Mamet, you know, with the cons going on and the twists, yep. Several twists and the macho characters.
Absolutely.
And I actually liked that stuff. And I like mm-hmm. to see Ricky Jay, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, I do too.
I thought all these characters were fun. And I wasn't exactly sure how the con was working or whether there was a con at first, you know. And I like to see that stuff unfold. And he mm-hmm. likes to show it with, you know, clock-like. Yep. He's very meticulous when he shows that sort of thing.
Yep.
And yet, I was also thinking about this thing that he wrote recently in the Village Voice. I don't know if you know about this, but
I didn't.
He renounced liberalism and has become a conservative and wrote about it in the Village Voice. And this is the first movie or play that he's done since then. You know, I don't know when he came to this conclusion or, you know, if it affected the movie in any way. But the movie is about a guy who has a tiny little jiu-jitsu dojo, you know, but he sort of is sucked into a world that's more commercial. Mm-hmm. It's not his nature and he really wants to destroy it. And I think the movie to the end stays on his side. And yet the end didn't seem convincing to me. And I wasn't sure why this guy had done anything to earn, you know, the rewards that he's given at the end. And I wondered if it was maybe just because David Mamet doesn't really believe in this story mm-hmm. or this character anymore. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good thought. I hadn't thought about that. I'm actually surprised to hear that David Mamet was ever a liberal. You know, just sort of that the macho cynicism that runs through his films just doesn't strike me that way. But
maybe it's a con.
Yeah, maybe that's right. And I did like the con part of this movie too. I was telling a friend that it because I know it's a David Mamet film. If I hadn't, I wouldn't have been looking for a con at all. But because I know it's a Mamet film, I was looking for it right away. And so it was just kind of fun to sort of see it unfold and go, oh, yeah, that guy's lying. I know he's lying.
And it sort of unfolds in the realm of Hollywood, which is mm-hmm. kind of cool, too, mm-hmm. which we sort of think of as pristine, and yet here it's sort of dirty.
Yeah, yeah. And so when somebody, you know, suddenly appears, you know, sort of what would seem to be a coincidence, I know it's not a coincidence.
Yes.
You know, I know that this is all part of the elaborate conspiracy to test our hero. And yet when our hero finally gets a chance to, you know, do whatever he's supposed to do, it's strangely unsatisfying.
Yeah.
Not a bad movie. And Chiwetel Ejiofor, I think that's how you pronounce his name, is a great actor. And so I really enjoyed watching him in another good, strong role. And that means a lot.
Yeah.
Well, you saw a movie, and I just recently saw it, called Shotgun Stories, small little film that's making its way around the country. What's that about?
Well, it's about these guys. Do they live in North Carolina? Or where does this take place?
Arkansas.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's these guys who live in Arkansas, you know, four or five friends. Maybe they've been friends for a long time, since high school. You know, they've all sort of lived in this area. And it's just sort of about their lives. This is mm-hmm. directed by a guy named Jeff Nichols. It's his first film. But it's produced by David Gordon Green, a friend of his. And it feels in some ways like it belongs in that universe. You know, mm-hmm. this is just a very quiet observational movie. I liked, you know, there's a guy who lives out of his van that he parks by the lake, and I get sort of liked seeing how his days go, you know, as he sits outside and runs his appliances from some sort of a battery or generator or something. Yes. And there's sort of some strife that develops, and the movie spirals into this sort of
family feud.
Yeah, feuds and sort of tit for tat and escalation. And I for some reason, it didn't work as well for me. I think, again, because it was leaving behind the parts that I liked and because it was just becoming, oh, and I'm going to go over and beat that guy's ass now and we're going to watch that. Yeah. But I've read a few things about it that a lot of people have seen more interesting metaphors in that than I did. I just felt like he was writing a story and that this he felt like was a good way to end it. I'm not sure he was thinking beyond that. And so for me, it felt like a decent first film and perhaps a promising filmmaker that we can watch, but not a, I don't think a new genius, you know?
No, I completely agree with all of that. I really liked these characters. And so the first half of the movie where he's building them out of the small details of their lives. I liked that. And I liked how we even learn a little bit about some of the secondary characters in the film. But once the plot takes over and we really just get into this feud, I just didn't find that as interesting. It's not that I was bored, but I didn't like it as much as I liked the first half of the movie.
Yeah. The only known actor in the movie is Michael Shannon. Everyone else is a non-professional. But Michael Shannon, I thought he was particularly well cast because he doesn't stick out like a sore thumb. He sort of fits in with the rest of these guys. And he has this sort of perpetual scowl that sort of seems like a lot of history is welled up in that face, you know, and I liked that. And it also gives you the sense that it could spring back out at any moment, you know, I sort of liked that. It's not menacing necessarily, but a little bit. So in the middle of this calm world in the first half of the movie is that face. And so I liked that too.
You know, I think the thing I liked most was how much I learned about the characters from where they live. You know, the movie has really chosen carefully the various houses that we see and the very various living arrangements that they have. And I just found that really satisfying that someone took the time to say, okay, what sort of house would this character live in? What sort of van would this guy live in? And so I liked that. I thought that was really, really useful.
Yeah. Now, there's a movie out. It's kind of moving around the country slowly, but it's a British film called Son of Rambo. And this is a movie that I think it may have sort of flown under the radar and a lot of people haven't seen it, but it's a movie that should have, I would think, broad appeal. I mean, it's just a really fun movie. It's about these two kids who are going to a prep school in England, and it takes place, I guess, in the 80s, but it sort of feels like it's timeless. You know, they were in uniforms. They could be Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer almost, you know. In fact, one of the kids is a troublemaker and the other kid is from a really strict family. And so he's used to being a good kid. And the movie throws those two together in really clever ways. And then they happen to see a bootleg of Sylvester Stallone's movie, First Blood, the first Rambo film, and it, you know, fundamentally changes their lives. And so they have to, you know, they sort of have to make their own version of it on videotape. So it's similar in some ways to Be Kind, Rewind, although I liked this more because it was really not so much about that aspect of it. It was about these characters and what they're like and this juxtaposition of an old style tweed and bricks school with a sort of new modernity of video, and then this there's this European exchange student who comes from France, and then suddenly it's like new wave is thrown into this mix as well. And so it really observes that juxtaposition of styles and cultures really, really well. But mostly that sounds sort of highfalutin. Really, it's just a fun and funny movie, and so I think a lot of people should check it out on DVD if it doesn't come to your town. You know, on a previous podcast, I talked about how I don't recommend a lot of movies to people. I just sort of give my impression. This is a movie. The reason I'm saying that I think people should go rent it is because I have told so many people that I know would like it to go check it out that I'm feeling like I'm feeling bold and I can step up and say, you know, I think a lot of people who just want a fun time at the movies, this is a fun movie to see.
Well, good. And I know we've ripped on a few of the summer blockbusters and you know, it's not that I'm against entertainment anyway. It just would be nice if it was smart entertainment. So it sounds like Son of Rambo is. I'll make sure to check that out. Another smart movie, maybe a little more esoteric, is a movie called Reprise from Norway, directed by Joachim Trier. And it's about these two young men, probably around 20 years old, who are both aspiring writers. And the movie has this great opening where this very droll voiceover imagines their own lives, these two guys, you know, once they hit it big as authors. You know, they're about to submit their own manuscripts, and, you know, that what happens if it gets published and they become sensations and so forth and so on. And it's really fun. And then the movie is about what actually happens when they submit these manuscripts. One of them is rejected. One of them is accepted. But then the author, who becomes a little bit of a cause celeb, has trouble dealing with that success. And so the movie is about the relationship between these two guys. But I thought it was really great. There's a lot of French New Wave sort of feel about it. And it's shot with this pale Scandinavian light that I thought was really beautiful. And I liked the characters, and I thought that their relationship and the people around them were interesting. I know you saw it. What do you think?
Well, I saw it a long time ago, and so it hasn't stuck with me. And so I don't remember a lot of things about it, and some of that is my fault. I saw it at Sundance a couple of years ago.
Oh, okay.
And for some reason, it's been delayed coming out. I don't know why. But I do remember liking the sort of new wavy aspect of it. You know, in the French New Wave of the 50s and 60s was just so playful with cinema. And, you know, it felt like they could do anything. And some of that is lost in, you know, something like Indiana Jones. It feels like they can't do anything. They have to follow this very rigid, you know, schema. Where this, it had a lot of that. And it also just was about people and their relationships. It wasn't about any sort of major drama. It was just what happens in their lives. And so it was sort of like the new wave in that way, too.
Yeah, and for me, it's nice that there are these really funny moments. But then there are some very serious moments in the film. And I think that film is able to go from, you know, comedy to drama and back and forth in ways that are organic. They don't feel out of place. And it ends in a way that I thought was satisfying as well. Now, there's three French films that have been playing both here in Chicago and around the country the last few months that you've seen. Stack them up for us, Rob.
Well, we have The Duchess of Langeais by the great Jacques Rivette, speaking of the New Wave. He's one of those guys, and he's still making movies. There's also The Last Mistress by Catherine Breillat, and Boarding Gate by Olivier Assayas. And two of these movies star Asia Argento, who just seems to be everywhere these days. She's also in Abel Ferrara's new movie, Go-Go Tales. And she's in her father's movie, Mother of Tears. Mm-hmm. Her father is Dario Argento, who's known for making these Italian horror films. Mm-hmm. But these three movies are not horror films. They're different, but it was kind of fun to see all three together because they're sort of about an intense relationship, each one about a woman and a man, and it's not clear who's possessing whom. And there's real need and desire to possess this woman, and she seems maybe like she's frail and could be possessed, and so we're not sure if that's a good thing or not. You wouldn't think so. And yet, Asia Argento is not the sort of person who is a waif and easily controlled. And I liked how that sort of showed up in all of these movies. My favorite of the three might be, and it's sort of, I'm not sure I'm going to say this out loud, but it might be Boarding Gate, the Olivier Assayas movie. And the reason I say that is because he's made some really great movies. Irma Vep is one of them, but they're all sort of cerebral and sort of, he likes to deconstruct genres and he's made a lot of movies that have sort of beautiful women carrying guns or wearing black leotards sneaking into buildings and buildings with lots of glass. And these are just sort of ingredients that he likes to mix and match. And it's kind of cool to see how he does that. In this movie, he's doing all that, but he's also sort of adopting the genre. He's really, this could almost be La Femme Nikita, you know. It's like La Femme Nikita, but it looks better, you know. it flows in a more interesting way, and so I liked that because I like to see a good movie in that genre. And yet I think it was also a little disappointing because he could probably, I would like to see him do something a little more provocative. But all three of these movies were worthwhile, and I liked them a lot.
With the Rivette film, because I that's the only one of the three that I've seen, I find myself a little disappointed in part because it's a costume drama, and that never works as well for me. But what did you find interesting about the relationship between the Marquis and the Duchess in that film?
Well, I thought it was so, I thought the movie itself was really rich. And one reason I don't have more to say about it, I think, is because I'd like to see it again at some point. Mm. But one thing I liked about the relationship was this who's possessing whom thing. You know, I think there, through most of the movie, it's the guy believes it's very clear who's possessing whom. And yet it's not sure that's true. The other thing I liked about it is that location, location, location is very important. It's not necessarily where you are that's important, but it's where you seem to be. And so that comes up several times. You know, the Duchess parks her carriage outside of a house at one point, and there's that causes all this little gossip. And oh my goodness, the Duchess is at this guy's house, or she's been there for hours, you know. And it turns out, well, I'm not sure if I should say. She might not be in that carriage, you know. But it doesn't matter. She can accomplish, you know, her goal. And I liked how it was almost like a proxy war, you know. There were a lot of neat things about the movie in that way.
Oh, that's interesting. A much more pedestrian film, but one that's been doing good business around the country, is this documentary called Young at Heart, which is about this group of senior citizens. And when I mean senior citizens, I mean, you know, people in their 80s and 90s and some in their 70s too, who sing in a choir, but they sing rock songs and they sing punk songs that have been sort of rearranged into, you know, things that a choir could sing, and they play in front of adoring audiences. And when I mean adoring, the movie opens with a standing ovation that the people have received. I went to see this movie just because the reviews had been really good. It's not the sort of thing I usually like. And yet, in spite of lots of things that I don't like about the film, I found myself genuinely moved by it. Let me start with the things that I find annoying. One is these senior citizens are just the cutest people on the face of the earth. You know, the movie just wants to just show how cute and how funny they are, and it just taps into all these stereotypes we have about lovable 85-year-olds who are singing songs by The Clash. And the director, Stephen Walker, just inserts himself into the movie in ways that I found really problematic. It's like, no, dude, I don't really care about you. Why are you, you know, why are you telling me where you were on this day, or why are you telling me what you're feeling about this situation? Not important. And yet, despite this and other, you know, sort of dubious choices the movie makes, the very fact that these people are very clearly facing their mortality head on is just very powerful. And it's not a theme that I think we see in movies very often, you know, what it's like to be old, what it's like to try to still be vibrant and yet struggle with that, you know, what it's like to, you know, sing songs that you, you know, have no idea what they're about, and yet you're trying to somehow still be youthful and still be alive, is genuinely compelling. And the movie builds to this final concert, in which this these two gentlemen are going to sing this duet of a song by Coldplay, and then one of the singers, one of the guys, dies like a week before the concert. You know, certainly not something that you could have scripted at all. And so it's just the one guy singing this song by himself. And you know, gosh darn it, if I didn't just start weeping in the middle of the theater. It's just really powerful. And so, is it manipulative? Yeah, it is. And yet it was also thought-provoking, and I've been kind of thinking about it, or, you know, wrestling with it ever since. So, and for people who don't have the same hang-ups about documentary form that I do, I think would really, really like it.
It is a popular movie. It was a really popular movie at Sundance as well. I can't give an opinion of this movie because I actually walked out at about 45 minutes, and that says it's not. Don't take that as harsh as it sounds. But it just sort of the parts that I saw were pushing some buttons that I just felt like I don't feel like this movie today. And it's interesting to hear you talk about the sort of conflict that you feel about the movie too, because I kept thinking of those last few Johnny Cash recordings.
Yep.
And especially this video that Mark Romanek made for one of the songs on the last album. And it felt like it was just using Johnny Cash's legacy and history to tell this maudlin tale and sort of imply that he's reflective on this in a really regretful way. And it was sort of like this young video director just mining someone's life, bringing this to him and putting him through these motions like a puppet. And I always just set really funny with, for me. You know, I like the first of those sort of last three he made called American Recordings, but I felt like they started to follow a pattern. And this movie, at least what I saw of it, reminded me of that because, you know, you've got these people singing I Want to Be Sedated and they're learning the Coldplay song, and I get the feeling that this is somehow supposed to be meaningful to them, and yet it was just handed to them, and I'm not sure it is meaningful to them. I'm not sure they really like to sing I Want to Be Sedated or, you know, make these little videos. It just felt funny. I don't know what to say beyond that.
Yeah, no, and it's I agree with that, and that's how I was feeling at about the 45-minute mark, too. And yet the movie... did you see the part? I can't remember if this is in the first half or the second half. The seniors are invited to sing at this prison.
No, I think that was about the point that I was gone, I believe.
Okay, so they're invited to sing at this prison for a bunch of inmates. Well, it just so happens that morning, one of their members passes away, and so they have to make this decision about whether they're going to sing, and they do. The movie actually lets them sing two or three songs full on at the prison that we see. And again, it's just very powerful to see, you know, how they're dealing with this, how they're dealing with the loss and how they process that through song. And I, you know, that was the moment at where the movie started to turn for me.
Well, good. And sometimes it can be important to stay. I mean, it's the eternal question of if a movie is good until the last minute and then it just has a horrible final minute, how much does that affect what you think of the movie? And vice versa, if it sort of redeems itself, which I saw another movie recently called Stuck, which stars Mina Suvari and Stephen Ray. And it was directed by this guy, Stuart Gordon, who made a movie in the 80s called Reanimator. And this was it's a staple of, you know, HBO or Showtime, when I was growing up. There's this juice that you can inject into dead things and they come back to life. They're reanimated, you know, they're sort of like zombies. It's kind of like a zombie movie. Mm-hmm. This guy has a weird visual sense. Well, this movie, Stuck, is about, a homeless guy, played by Stephen Ray, who is hit by a car driven by Mina Suvari, and he goes head first into the windshield and he's sort of stuck, you know, half in, half out. She's not sure what to do. And so she drives home and parks the car in her garage and goes on about her business thinking he's dead, but he's not. The rest of the movie, he's there. Now this sounds like a high concept and it's a midnight type of movie. And I don't often go for that sort of thing. And in the first 10, 15, maybe even 20 minutes, I was thinking, you know, I had heard that this was kind of a crazy movie. You got to see it, but this is not going to do it for me. But I stayed, and I have to say, it gets really good. At first, of course, I'm thinking, I'm not sure I like this Mina Suvari character. I don't think she's very nice, and I'm not sure that I'm going to believe it when it eventually redeems her, you know, in some way, or she learns something from this. Well, I had this movie pegged to the wrong board. This movie is very satisfying by the end in a really sleazy, trashy, but fun way and crazy kind of a movie. And it's the kind of movie that when you walk out, you want to tell, certain people, hey, go see this. I think you're going to like it.
I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up about endings and how they can, you know, sometimes ruin a movie, sometimes redeem it. For me, endings are unbelievably critical. And so for like Iron Man, as I was saying earlier, a film that I was really grooving on for three quarters of it, it kind of ruined it for me in that last half hour. Whereas other films can, if they sort of, you know, steal victory out of the jaws of defeat, can save the day with a really satisfying ending. Now, it doesn't usually happen. Usually good movies are good all the way through. Bad movies are bad all the way through. But it can be, you know, for like to go back to the very first movie we talked about, Indiana Jones. You know, I found the ending of that movie particularly unsatisfying. And I think if it had been able to snatch victory at the end, I would have liked it a lot more. But instead, it went in the direction that I thought it was going. And that just didn't do much for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree about that. Well, as Pearline says at the end of Ghost Dog, the end is important in all things. And we've come to the end of our speed round. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Errata Movie Podcast. can find more episodes in this series of programs at erratamag.com/podcast. That's erratamag.com. There you can also leave comments and feedback. Or if you prefer to leave an audio comment, call 415-287-4020. We'll be back next time with more stuff. Bye.